On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Think about the English people and you might think of stereotypical traits, a cool reserve, a sense of irony, a love of gardens and pubs, a stiff upper lip. But British cultural critic A.A. Gill has one word for all that Englishness: rubbish. The English are, above all, an angry people, he says, full of grievances, annoyance, and violence. In his new book, Gill travels the land of King Arthur and Queen Elizabeth, flaying his countrymen. The whole petty, sentimental lot. Good sport hunting the English, Gill says. Americans should have some, too. Joining us in a moment from London is A.A. Adrian Gill, writer for the Sunday Times of London, GQ, and Vanity Fair. He is a restaurant and television critic, a travel writer, humorist, and big media personality in Britain. His book, The Angry Island, Hunting the English, has just come out in the U.S. It stirred up outrage when it was published in the U.K. The New York Times says it showcases Mr. Gill's gifts for writing rude invective. So, turning to Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. Great to have you, Jack. What do you take of this definition of English anger that Adrian Gill seems to profess?
Well, how about if I just quote a few of his lines?
Yes,
and we'll get a flavor of it. He begins a chapter called Sorry with this: England's default setting is anger. Lapel poking, Chinese burning, ram raiding, street shouting, sniping, spitting, shoving, vengeful, invective rage. But many of the traits and tics that make the English so similar and occasionally admirable are the deflective mechanisms that they've invented to diffuse anger, the tolls and speed bumps and diversions of anger. Not giving in to your nature is very English, clinging on, white-knuckled, bottling the urges, refusing to slide into spittle-flecked release of snarling national fury. That's quite a piece of writing.
Yeah, these are my favorites. Naturally, congenitally, collectively, and singularly livid much of the time.
Yeah.
They can be mildly annoyed, really annoyed, and most scarily, not remotely annoyed.
Remotely annoyed.
Yeah. They sit apart on their half of a damply, disappointingly little island, nursing and picking at their irritations.
You know, it's sublimated anger, if it's anger. It's anger that's found its way into the retort, the repartee, the comeback. You know, someone says to Churchill, Clement Attlee is a humble man. And Churchill immediately says, yes, and he's got a lot to be humble about. You know, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
An American politician saying anything that clever? It's inconceivable. And so you can see, it seems to me, in these comebacks, a will to, if not aggression, toward aggression, then to put your best face forward and not to take it. I mean, you know, to me, when Tony Blair was leaving the House, a conservative member was saying to him, well, you know, Mr. Blair, you really have basically been too kind to the Europeans and showed you were weak on Europe and all the rest. And Blair gave a speech to him in talking about substance, and at the end, and he said, and in parting, let me say to you, au revoir. Arrivederci, and auf Wiedersehen.
Now, we actually have established a connection to London now, Jack, and so let us welcome A.A. Gill, Adrian Gill, author of The Angry Island. Nice to have you, Adrian. Thanks for being here. Sorry we've had such problems getting you.
I'm not sitting in a room.
Ah, good. Jack Beatty and I have been reading some excerpts from your book and discussing sort of your premise here. Why don't you give us your best definition of English anger?
English anger is mostly a sort of completely impervious face. I have no idea what was going on behind it. What the English mostly do when they're really, really furious is breathe slightly harder.
But they have a reputation of being just the opposite, you know, this sort of reserved and cool sense. So this is sort of a broad, sort of sweeping generalization of a people,
yeah, I mean,
isn't it?
Isn't that just so perfidious of them? That's exactly what they do. Is that the whole point of English anger is that it's internalized, and it has been internalized for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Most of what the English do is based on this great seeping sludge of repressed fury, which they've handed down to each other lovingly.
So where does it come from? Where does that repressed fury you mentioned, where did it start?
Well, that's a, you know, I know this is a flaw in my book, is that I don't really explain that. And I'm not entirely sure that I know in myself terribly. It's Winston Churchill said that it was because the English were a mongrel race made up of the most psychotically violent people known to Europe, the Vikings, the Normans, the Saxons, and the Celts. And that may have something to do with it. Mostly, I think it's to do with lots of little things that come together to make the one big English rage. And it's things like the weather being always bad. The English are constantly intellectually optimistic and emotionally pessimistic. I mean, you sort of hope everything is going to be all right, and in the end, it always rains.
optimistic and emotionally pessimistic. So was there a particular event, or what made you want to write a book about this collection of prejudice, if you will?
Yes, prejudice based on experience. I suppose I have always had this sense of I mean, I live in England. If you listen to me, you know, I sound completely English. Most people would just assume that I'm an Englishman, but I've lived here all my life, bar 1 year. But I've always felt that I don't really belong to them. I mean, I feel like I'm deep undercover, watching these rather odd people struggle with themselves.
So, Adrian, in your book, you take on every aspect of English culture, and I'd like you to take us through some of that as well now. Starting with the class system, which you call unfair, cruel, and above all, smug, you say. Would you explain?
Well, yes, I think that I must say that one of the biggest changes in my lifetime in England has been really the demise of the class system. Class is now used mostly by people who want to have a shorthand to make a political point or a statement. It's not something that most people on a bus or in the street deal in unless they're angry about something. It's really a way of being insulting. And as usual, most of the way you use it is by calling people middle class, which is... But the truth is that almost everybody here is now middle class by any standard measure that you would use over the last century. Everybody's now achieved middle classness, but it was a terrible smug way of that the English had of keeping people down and constantly belittling them. And I mean, it was always that liberal thing where you loved people in general, and you could say that you could despise them in particular, so that you could worry about the lot of the working class, but still think that your own cook was deeply embarrassing.
And you talk in your book about how the class system sort of seeps into language, the British accents, which you call a never-ending source of subtle snobbery. Why are accents so important in England, Adrian?
It's really astonishing, and it took an Irishman to really notice it. George Bernard Shaw, who said, you know, an Englishman only has to open his mouth for another Englishman to despise him. And indeed, of course, he wrote Pygmalion, which became My Fair Lady, which is really all about the ridiculousness of accent. And the voice that I am now speaking to you in, which is generally called received pronunciation, sometimes called BBC English, and is... The English assume is the default setting for English. This voice is the voice that you're supposed to hear Wordsworth and Shakespeare in. It is the proper English accent. And even people who don't have it would say that I was speaking proper. And that all the other accents, the regional accents, the Cockney, Northern, Scottish, Irish, Welsh, were all somehow less real than this one is. And of course, it's a complete travesty. The language, the accent I have now, is this odd thing that was born out of, probably out of the 19th century, and is a commercial accent. It's an accent that was made by English public schools and the civil service. And it's really the best accent for lying to people in. It's you'll notice that compared to the way you talk, is that I have very short vowels and quite distinct consonants, whereas the way you speak is with much longer vowels and much shorter consonants. Mm. And vowels are where we keep our emotion in our language. Vowels are very emotive. And consonants are where we keep facts. So when I talk, it sounds, and because I'm talking in iambic pentameter, it sounds like I'm, and in a major key, I'm being emphatic and I'm telling you things and I'm telling you the truth and you believe me. When you talk to me, I feel your emotion. I feel you're either angry or happy or pleased to see me. And the English really don't want to give away an awful lot of emotion, and they do want you to believe them. So they came up with this voice, which I frankly wish I never had, but I can't. I'm stuck. Mr.
Jack Beatty, jump in.
Yeah, Mr. Gill, this is Jack Beatty. A question on that. You know, I mean, we're dealing in the realm of woolly generalization here, but when I think of English writing, I think of very proficient writing and just writers who can, you know, they can really they do justice to the language in every way. But when I think of the great American writers, I think of something else. I think of power. I think of Melville. I think of I think of Faulkner. I think of people. I think of Philip Roth. I think of people who try not to be correct, but to actually reach into your skin and shake you. And I don't connect that with the English writers, much as I admire them.
No, I think that's quite a profound point. And I would in general, and please let's stick to generalization. That's so much nicer than being specific. I think in general that's absolutely true. I also think that that Americans are much easier in writing in a colloquial sense because all of your accents are regionally based. So a Kennedy in Boston will sound the same way as the man who sells peanuts in a baseball ground because they're both Bostonians and they have both Boston accents. That's not the same for England. You know, the people who live next door to me will have very different accents if they were educated differently. Mm. And that's what I think is what makes it easier for Americans to talk with this great, I mean, I think of someone like Mark Twain who has this amazing ability to be conversational with you, also Melville in Moby Dick, but it doesn't come naturally to English writing, which seems to have an accent or a voice that only exists in literature. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have an equivalent in the street. Or I mean, I think when you hear it in your head, you probably hear old actors saying it. But I mean, you know, the truth is that Shakespeare probably had a Birmingham accent, which is one of the most laughable of all our accents. I mean, of course, all our accents, except for the one I'm speaking with, are laughable, but that's a particularly funny one.
Thanks for the question, Jack. Let's go to the phones. David is calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. David, hi, you're on with Adrian Gill.
Hi, guys. This is great. I think so much of the great British comedy comes out of anger and out of repressed anger. I just bought my wife the complete series of Fawlty Towers on DVD, and we have been watching it, and we have been on the floor because John Cleese is just a volcano of anger.
Let's listen to it. David, thanks for bringing that up. We actually have a clip from the 1970s British comedy show Fawlty Towers. John Cleese's character serves dinner to some German tourists, and he continues to make awkward references to World War II, eventually making a German woman cry. He then tries to rectify things.
Stop it! Stop it! I'm trying to cheer her up, you stupid crouch!
It's not funny for her, not for us, not for any German people.
You have absolutely no sense of humor, do you?
This is not funny!
Who won the bloody war anyway?
Adrian Gill, talk about the humor of the British. You say their humor is a coping mechanism.
I was just wondering how much you had to hate your wife to give her that as a present. but John, yes, John Cleese, of course, is an absolutely, in as Basil Fawlty, is an archetypal English person that everybody here would recognise. And in fact, he got that character from a hotel, I think, when he was in Monty Python that they were all staying in, and there was a simply appalling hotelier, and he stored him away and used him later for that to invent that character. But I've written a whole chapter about the English and humor. The English are very proud of their sense. One of the worst things you can say to an Englishman is that you lack a sense of humour. I mean, it's really like saying, you know, you're bad in bed. I mean, and actually, probably most Englishmen would probably mind that more. I mean, humour is as English as football and fish and chips and all those other cliches. And actually, I think, and the point I'm again making in the book is that in the world you can split humour into two types. There's Jewish humour and there's English humour. And Jewish humour is the humour of the victimized people, and English humor is the humor of bullies, and most English humor is bullying is deeply unpleasant if you actually, you know, don't laugh at it, and it's about getting at people, and it's an enormous valve for the English to get rid of any fantastic amount of invective and fury that they have about things.
Back to the phones now for another comment and question. Allie is in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Allie, hi, you're on the line with Adrian Gill.
Yes, hi, Jean. This is Allie. And this is very fascinating. I don't have a lot of experience with British people directly. However, I'm from an English family. And sharp comments, sarcasm, humor, snippy, insulting things are really, you know, commonplace. And I was always more sensitive and never seemed to, you know, dig that way of relating. And it does seem to be a way of getting back at people for the feelings and things you're upset about. It doesn't build a lot of happiness and love. And it does seem to be about people, from my experience with my family, of not wanting to show their emotions and actually being very sensitive people and using this as a way to protect their sensitivity that they don't want to acknowledge. And also, interestingly, you spoke about the Viking, Norman, Saxon, Celts. I study a lot about nutrition. And what I found is that people who are very aggressive eat a lot of meat and really are pushing. And if they can't get that aggression out in physical ways, they'll use what they have. They'll use their mouth and they'll attack. And maybe that just kind of went down through the centuries and people kept that habit in that way. But it's very fascinating.
Thanks for your call, Allie. Thanks so much. Adrian, you want to pick that up?
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I think you said you didn't know much about the English, but that seems to be, all of that was absolutely spot on. That inability to show emotion, but doing it through humor, and the spitefulness of it, and the relentless irony and joking and teasing. I mean, most English families are held together by webs of sort of mutually assured destruction by humour, and it never ever stops. I once spoke to a cancer doctor who'd worked in both America and in England, and he said that when he had to tell people that they had cancer in America, people cried, and then they wanted to know an enormous amount of technical detail. And he said, in England, invariably, people started making jokes, and they didn't stop making jokes until they died. and he said it was perfectly obvious that they were incapable of really properly dealing with the information, and that the default setting for dealing with the information was to make fun of it. And the English love that. I mean, they think being able to joke in the face of adversity, or in hardship, or in loss, is an enormous piece of character. And in fact, it's just the inability to deal with the reality of things.
Back to the phones to speak with Ben, who's calling from Deerfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Ben, you're on the line.
Hi, Mr. Gill, I'm really enjoying this show. I read a book a few years ago called Revolutionary Empire. I misremembered its title when I called in. But it had the theory that the English people took over the world because they were an obnoxious, arrogant, overbearing, just unstoppably boorish people, and that the British Empire went downhill starting around the 18th century when the English people developed good manners, proper breeding, reserve, and all the, you know, things that we hypothetically believe in them now. And I'm wondering how that fits in with your theory.
I think that could be said, that I think that's a very workable argument, and I think that will see you through almost any dinner party. It could also be really the arc of almost all empires. I think you could say the same thing about the Roman Empire, is that in the end what happens is that empires are made by people who are psychopathic pirates and end up being run by people who are deeply squeamish about what it is they're called to do to keep an empire together. And that, I think that was certainly true about the English. One of the things there are a number of things that made the English, that gave the English their empire, which is a central part of the English, in the English sense of itself, was the idea of having had an empire and of having this huge amount of the world that you ruled, and then no longer having it. So those two things really are very central to being English. But an awful lot of it was luck. It was luck that we were really competing against the French, which is always luck if you compete against the French.
One last call, Adrian, before we go to the break. I want to hear from Colin, who's in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Colin, you're on.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask about the the English music, like the Led Zeppelin and Beatles, and how they came up with such, like, to me, insightful lyrics. And I was wondering if the angry British mentality influenced these lyrics. And I'll
Great
take
question.
My call off here.
Colin, thank you. Adrian?
Yes, I think they absolutely did. I mean, when you can understand the lyrics, of course, most Led Zeppelin lyrics are complete nonsense. But there is most of those groups came out of either came out of English public schools, which are just soups of violence and appalling behaviour and rage. Or they came out of the working classes, like the Beatles in Liverpool, which also have a lot of reasons for being being quite angry about things. But I think there is a heritage of protest singing, as there also is in America, of course. But it's a really long heritage of a history of English protest singing of anger about working class lives, or about the restrictions of growing up in this country, and also it's a very small and parochial island. There isn't anywhere to really go and be on your own or to be away. I mean, you're never further than 50 miles from someone you're related to here. So, music was a great escape for a lot of kids in England.
Wanted to ask you if you think people are angrier in the English countryside or in the cities. And why?
Oh, I'm much, much angrier in the countryside. English countryside is pretty dreadful. The countryside everywhere is pretty dreadful. But, I mean, the country people are furious.
Because?
Well, they're furious mostly because they don't live in the cities, and they think that everything bad comes out of the cities, and people in cities still have more money than they do.
Joining us today is A.A. Adrian Gill, author of The Angry Island, Hunting the English, and a big cultural critic on the other side of the pond. And Jack Beatty, also with us, On Point analyst. I wanted to set up the first question of this segment with a clip, Adrian, of the 1957 film The Bridge on the River Kwai. It depicts a Japanese prisoner of war camp holding Allied and British soldiers. And in this particular scene, the imprisoned Colonel Nicholson, played by Alex Guinness, shows a stiff upper lip in confronting the colonel. Here it is.
Perhaps you are not aware that the bridge is now under my personal command.
Really? And may I ask, are you satisfied with the work?
I am not.
You've proved my point.
I hate the British. You are defeated. But you have no shame. You are stubborn, but have no pride. You endure, but you have no courage. I hate the British.
Pointless going on like this.
Adrian, listening to that, I'm interested in how the English are perceived by foreigners. What do you make of America and its response to the English?
Oh, I think America's fantastically forgiving of the English. I don't know of any ex-colonial country that is as forgiving or as fond of the colonial power as the Americans are about the English. And of course the positions of relative power are inverted, so that makes it easier. But I think there are a lot of things that the English have that the Americans are very pleased still exist, but are quite pleased they don't have to have themselves.
Such as?
Well, you know, table manners. all that literature we were talking about before. You know, it's nice that somebody writes poetry as long as we just don't have to read it. The high ground of incredibly, you know, 4-hour stage plays, all that sort of culture and that being like Alec Guinness. I think that you find that admirable, but you wouldn't want to have it yourself, and you wouldn't want to be married to it, and you certainly wouldn't want to be brought up by it. So I think England is quite a good place for dumping a whole lot of things that you think are worth it. It's sort of, England, if you put it as a shorthand, England is America's attic.
And if I may, I think one salient contrast is Americans' attitude toward winning. One of our favorite famous coaches said, winning is the only thing. And yet you rightly say the English don't like winners, and they don't like people who behave like winners. The best thing to do if you're caught winning is to slip away blushing. And, you know, to me, an illustration of that, perhaps at the most, the supreme moment in modern history for the British, April 1918, the Western Front. The Germans have just made their big push. They've rolled up British divisions. It looks like the war is going to end with a German victory. And Douglas Haig, the field marshal, writes his order of the day to the troops. Mind you now, they're being driven back. And he says, the safety of our homes and the freedom of mankind alike depend on the conduct of each one of us at this critical moment. With our backs to the wall, and believing in the justice of our cause, each one of us must fight on to the end. He doesn't say victory. He doesn't say triumph. He doesn't say got to win. He says each one of us must fight on to the end. Mm. That's so British.
Mm. What is the fascination, Adrian, with this sentimental sort of celebration of war in England?
It's one of the things about the English that I'm most in tune with, and I understand that very famous the backs to the wall speech by order from Haig, and there's a lot of the same sort of tenor of understatement in a lot of the great speeches from Churchill at that moment before America came into the war, when England, Britain was the only country fighting Germany in 1940, and there's that sense of you know, I have nothing to offer but blood, sweat, toil, and tears, and no, the English. I wanted to go back to the thing about games, because the English invented almost every single game in the world. I mean, astonishingly, why one country should have invented as many games, or at least set the rules for as many games as the English did. And the point of them was they were part of the public school ethos to train people to go and work and run the empire. And you had to train people to be a certain type of person. It didn't obviously matter how much Latin they knew, or indeed probably how much of any of the other school work they did. They had to be a certain type of character, and games build character. That was the idea. But the bit of games that really build character is how you deal with losing, not how you win. So the losing was the character-building bit of games, and I think that is one of the reasons that the English still admire plucky second bests rather than boastful firsts.
Back to the phones now. David is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the line.
Hi. Hi, it's David. I'm calling from Dorchester, and I've had a lot of experience with the British, particularly through my house in Canada. But I, I visited London in the 70s all winter, and I remember distinctly one gray day after another. And those gray days, I think, sort of define the English people, because you look for warmth in the pubs and other places. Can you ask the moderator there to comment on that? I'll take it off the air.
Thanks so much, David. What about the weather has to do with all of this, Adrian?
Oh, I think hugely. I mean the weather is as anybody who's been here knows is the great topic of conversation. I mean, it is when you have nothing to say, you talk about the weather. We also, the English have immensely changeable weather. Most of the continental United States, given global warming, you sort of know what the weather's going to be like. I mean, there is a pattern to weather that doesn't vary that much because of the particular place that England is in, or the island of Great Britain is, because of the Gulf Stream. Our weather changes constantly. Mm. So you can have three or four types of weather in a single day. And I do know those long, it seems endless months of just grayness where the cloud hangs just above your head like dirty washing.
Here's another call, Adrian. Let me get Valerie in from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Valerie, you're on the line.
Hi, how are you? This is a wonderful show. It's making me laugh so hard because I'm a Canadian and I was weaned on wonderfully rage-filled British humor. Of course, in Canada, though, we developed a very twisted version of it. We are big complainers, but we also have the added aspect where we apologize to other people for doing things to us. So it's all repressed rage. You know?
A version of it. Valerie, thanks for your call. Back to Julie in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Julie, you're on the line.
Hi. I've been to England and Great Britain many, many times, but the story I wanted to tell was how I had stayed in a village in the Cotswolds for 6 or 7 years for like 3 weeks and went hiking every day, and every night I would go to the pub there. And I thought Roy, the owner, really sort of liked me as a person. And when I went back in 2002, he never mentioned 9/11, had I or my niece lost any friends or relatives in the disasters. And so the last night, Karen, I said to him, Roy, we don't understand that you never, ever commented on 9/11. And not in an angry way, Roy said, he went on this diatribe. He said, well, you Americans are glib, shallow, crude, money-grubbing, self-centered. And he went on and on. And I was absolutely shocked, as was my niece. And when he finally stopped to catch his breath, I said, yes, and that's exactly what makes America great, because I couldn't let this thing go on without making it humorous. And then, of course, I said, and who saved a certain anatomical part of the Brits in World Wars I and II? And he just sort of looked at me and he said, you're absolutely right. But, I mean, it was amazing. We were just flabbergasted. And I love the Brits. And then he said, Julie, I'm going on vacation. I'd like to come to the States. I said, you don't want to be with a bunch of money-grubbing, glib, obnoxious people. But he did.
He did. It's funny. Julie, thank you for your call and your story. Listen, Adrian, I wanted to turn to a couple more pieces from your book. You talk about the English tendency, which I thought was so funny, in the book to cue. Because if they didn't, you say, they'd kill each other.
Yeah, I mean, cues are a fantastic invention. I mean, nobody makes you cue. There was no cueing police force. You don't get arrested if you do it badly, but people do it. And the English are particularly aware of cues. And it also comes from coming from quite a hierarchical, traditionally quite a hierarchical society, is that they all know their place, and the queue is the one place in England which is where, you know, your bank manager has to get in line behind the dustman.
Pop culture question and a political question, and then back to the phones. Gordon Brown, visiting with our President Bush today. He's a Scotsman like you. What are people saying about him back in the homeland?
Well, you know, the truth about politics in England is that everybody hates politicians, and the hatred of politicians is constant and unvarying until they die, or until they do something so awful that they have to resign and go off and run boys' clubs for 20 years, and then people quite like them. But usually, I mean, we just hate all politicians. That being said, Brown's had quite a good opening couple of weeks, but it's early days yet. I mean, we'll loathe him again. He'll be like Tony Blair, you know, the most hated man in the country now. Mm. I mean, for being enormously successful.
Mm. And what about David Beckham, the new British invasion in the United States, Los Angeles, playing soccer? How do you feel about Beckham leaving your shores to come here?
Well, of course, he hasn't been here for some time. He has been in Spain.
Yeah.
We're sending him around the world.
But he's your boy. He's homegrown.
Yes, no, he absolutely is, and he is. He's enormously influential for young people in this country. I mean, he's been a great, I suppose, role model is the word. I mean, you know, people have looked to him for a long time for how they should look and how they should dress and all that, and him and his wife. And I mean, because most of us don't, of course, take any of it remotely seriously. I mean, it's very difficult to take sports people seriously as, you know, as anything other than, as Kipling said, you know, flannels, fools, or muddy dough.
Back to the phones now, to Cheshire, Connecticut, and Kathleen, who's on the line. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello, Dana. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I disagree with the premise that the English are an angry people, because anger is a passion. And I have always regarded the English people as pragmatic and passionless, as much as I don't like to stereotype.
Hmm.
But now, to support this, I would say that even going back to Victorian literature, many of the heroines were expected to marry for position rather than for passion.
Hmm.
Even into the 20th century, with the marriage of Princess Diana and Prince Charles, I think they were expected to be satisfied in a passionless marriage that looked good to the world.
Good point. Kathleen, we're running out of time, so I'm going to cut you off. Thank you for your call and turn it over to Adrian.
No, I think there's quite a lot of proof truth in that. I think you're wrong to think the English are passionless. I think they are riddled with all sorts of passion. The problem is they don't really know what to do with it. But they have enormous passions about things, but just sort of often not about each other, and often not about sex. I mean, in defence of English literature, I say that the person who wrote most about that sort of life was Henry James, of course, who was an American.
Yes, and the British are passionate about dogs. You've got some funny passages on that.
Yes, the English trait of kindness to animals gives an excuse
that's complete anthropomorphism. I mean, it's much easier to love your dog, you know, when you can't find the words to say anything nice to your children.
Jack Beattie, I'm going to give you the last minute to wrap up and your thoughts about Adrian Gill and the angry island of the English.
Well, I just want to bait him, if I might.
Mm.
Boswell, James Boswell of Scotland, is talking to Dr. Johnson, and he says, "Do you know, Scotland, sir, is a land of many fine prospects." And Johnson said, "Yes, sir. And the finest prospect a Scot sees is the high road that leads to England."
Of course, as a Scot, I would say is that by far and away the greater of the two men, of course, was Boswell. He's a far better writer than Johnson. And, of course, we wouldn't have Johnson at all if it wasn't for Boswell. I mean, Johnson wrote a very flawed dictionary, but Boswell invented the art of biography.
A.A. Adrian Gill has been our guest, a prominent British social critic and journalist whose writings range widely from television to the food to the unflattering traits of the English. His new book is called The Angry Island, Hunting the English. Appreciate your time today, Adrian. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, as always, Jack Beattie, our On Point news analyst. Jack, thanks to you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.